Hello. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, this is part four of a five-part discussion. It was conducted via Skype, and owing to a minor technical problem, one of our microphones was very hot and picked up an excessive amount of extraneous noise, specifically breathing and some other ambient sounds that you may hear. They are quite distracting, but we didn't want to abandon the discussion because it was very interesting. After this five-part is over, we should go back and not have this problem anymore, and I do apologize. We hope you'll bear with us on this episode and again on the next episode. And now on with the show.
Listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Welcome to episode 14 of Fusion Patrol. This is part four of our five-part discussion with Simon from littlestorping.co.uk, where we'll be discussing who is the best doctor of the new series Doctor Who's. At present, Christopher Eccleston has 2 points, David Tennant has 3 points, and Matt Smith is hanging on to a narrow lead with 4 points. We now continue our discussion with category number four, the pseudo-historical.
Okay, so yes, the pseudo-historical is, I mean, it's been a long time in Classic Who since there's been a pure historical, in which we haven't had an alien at all. And
Black Orchid?
I think Black Orchid would be the last one, yeah. So that would have been, what, 1984?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Certainly a while ago. And by then, that was the exception. They were definitely sticking aliens in all over the place.
Right.
And I don't think we've had anything that's been set in Earth's past that hasn't had to have an alien in it through various periods. And so this set of stories, we've got the Empty Child and the Doctor Dances, set during World War II. We've got the Idiot's Lantern, set in the 50s. We've got Human Nature and the Family of Blood, set just before the Great War. We've got the Fires of Pompeii, set on the eve of the volcano erupting. And we've got Vampires of Venice, set in Venice in, I'm not quite sure when.
Yeah, in the time of the plague.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
The Venice plague.
Venice plague that the Doctor had never heard of.
I think, I want to say, I don't know, 15, 1600s here, but I don't know. That's at a generic period in the past in Venice, a foreign place.
Yes, each one is set at some period in the past. But nevertheless, the thing that the Doctor and his companions have to overcome is, in fact, some extraterrestrial of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So in The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances, this is set during World War II, London during the Blitz, and this was the story which, for me, made me think, yes, Doctor Who the show is back, and it's capable of equaling and surpassing what came before. And of course, it was the first episode or first story that's been written by Stephen Moffat, and it had not just the wartime setting, but it also had the mysterious time traveller and the sinister alien. I mean, Moffat does really well on budget aliens, I think, because he tends to pick something that's terribly mundane and make it scary. So you've got a small child and a gas mask, and you can't get much cheaper than that. But it's great economy in the writing he does, but it's also great economy in the production, because you can then spend the money on CGI versions of the Blitz. And the story itself is, I think, really nicely done, because he manages to hit a balance which I think must be quite difficult in a pseudo-historical, where you're actually weighing up the peril that is threatened by, in this case, the rampant nanogenes, which is an extraterrestrial threat, and with that, at the same time, without diminishing the sort of daily misery and ordeal that the Londoners are going to continue to go through as the war progresses, even after the threat is saved. So all round, I think this is still one of my favourite episodes.
It's an interesting place in time, because you could, I don't know that they necessarily did, but you could argue that lots of stuff could be going on during the Blitz, because a lot of stuff was being blown up. So it's a really great place to lose something that was out of place and out of time, and then gets the traces of that existence removed. It's a great episode. It cemented, or at least it laid the first brick that said Moffat should be taking over Doctor Who. Captain Jack was a great character. Kind of a shame they put him in Torchwood, but he added a lot to it. One of the criticisms that you hear is the romance angle. This is really the first time the romance angle is played up, and sort of jealousy between the Doctor and Captain Jack. There are some other facets of this story that put it more adult, perhaps, than people were expecting. I know that kind of rubbed against the grain for a lot of people, at least over here.
Having the omnisexual character.
It's not just the omnisexual character. It's also the fact that, if you recall, the girl blackmails the butcher for food by pointing out that he's having an affair with a guy. Everybody thinks the butcher's wife is having an affair with a man, but in fact it's the man having the affair with a man. And she points that out, and then he's like, okay, you can have my food, or whatever happens to be. And it for me anyway, it's slightly oddly out of place. It's not that it just seems, you know, for a show that is a children. I mean, Moffat's the one that's been talking about that. Whether or not it's gay or straight sex, we're talking about blackmailing somebody over their sexual behavior. That's kind of a little bit strong for a kids program. And it came about here in Moffat's first episode. This is really the strongest incidence we see of this in the new series. It was odd, I thought at the time. But nonetheless, it doesn't detract from an excellent story and an absolutely best ending for a story that Christopher Eccleston ever had, if not one of the best ever in, you know, everybody lives and saves the day and ends up no one's dead. Well, apart from all the people being blown up in the Blitz, but from the alien technology.
I liked it pretty much too. I agree that this one felt more like, for the first time in the series, this one really felt more like a Doctor Who episode. And there was something very refreshing about that. I like Captain Jack. I thought he was a rather interesting character, and although as the episode goes on, he kind of reveals more about himself than I think might have been appropriate for the sake of the show. I loved the threat. I thought that was very well done, using at first this one child with this mask, and just repeating that one line, "Are you my mummy?" It's when you hear that, it after a while, it just it really begins to eat at you, and it created for some pretty good terror, not just for the characters, but for me as well. So I found that to be quite it made for a great story. I rather enjoyed it. The only thing I didn't like strongly was, again, Christopher Eccleston. I do not pretend that I have any fondness for his portrayals as a doctor. I rather hated him as the doctor. I don't deny that he's an excellent actor. I just didn't like the way he played the part. And this episode was no different. Two scenes that really bother me is when he has to finally reveal that while he does have something that is sonic. To me, it didn't play right as far as the doctor goes.
I love that scene.
It just didn't play right for me.
Me too.
I have to disagree. It did not work for me. And then at the end, while he was happy that everyone lived, I didn't like the way he did it. It was just over the top. And yes, the doctor has seen since this time. The doctor has seen a lot of death, a lot of destruction, mostly in the Time War. And I guess it's a safe assumption that just immediately after the Time War, the doctor regenerated into this person that we are talking about right now. So yes, maybe the idea of everybody living for once does mean a great deal to him, but as a viewer, it just felt odd. So those are my criticisms of the episode. Other than that, it was one that I did enjoy a great deal, and one that I could watch over and over again.
What one criticism I have of all the entire new Doctor Who is the notion that the Doctor is basically a storm. That when he comes in, people die and they go on. That detracts from the fact that the Doctor saves the day. To me, I mean, he is a hero. He's the hero. When he arrives, he's there to help, whether people believe that or not. He is going to save the day. He's going to solve the problem. He's going to make it less worse than it would have been if he had not shown up there. And yet, they have deliberately taken an attitude of pointing out that wherever the doctor goes, death is his companion. And I think that's just a poor way to look at it. It's true, but death is not his companion. He arrives where there is death, and he fixes it. I mean, that's like saying wherever a doctor goes, a medical doctor goes, he leaves a wake of death. Well, of course they do, because they can't save everyone. But it's backwards.
But sometimes it does get worse before it gets better. And sometimes he makes people confront things in a way which actually brings things to a point. So, rather than living under oppression, he might conceivably get people to rise up, and some of them may die.
That's true.
And it's that kind of tension that I think they're getting at. I do think there has been a deliberate, or at least previously there's been a deliberate focus on there being a certain body count. I'm pretty sure I've heard Russell T. Davies talk about making sure that, you know, people die at frequent intervals in it. And I think possibly the first Stephen Moffat episode where we see anyone die is Time of the Angels. Is that?
It could be.
I don't think he has a high body count.
He doesn't, although I think Girl in the Fireplace, somebody might have gotten killed in that one. I mean, not counting Madame de Pompadour dying of old age, but the crew is all killed. They got lots of dead body parts all over the place that kind of imply that.
Yes,
the,
that's true.
But we don't see that. But okay, we've got what? The Idiot's Lantern next?
Yes, indeed. So this is a Tenth Doctor and Rose 1950s set story featuring a monster in the television. It's another of those stories that has a very well-created period setting, and you can imagine that the BBC costume department had a ball doing this one, but I didn't have quite such a good time watching it. I thought it was reasonably entertaining, but it didn't have that sense of threat, and I think that's probably just because it wasn't a strong enough monster in this case.
Okay, having your face removed is not a big threat. I mean, how would you eat or breathe? never mind. Okay, there may have been some problems with that. Yeah. As a side note, I think it's interesting that this episode occurred at the same time that Gene Hunt from Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes was killed. It's like same day, I think. Wasn't that Coronation Day in the
Sphinx?
So there it is. That's what this was, because they were planning everyone in the country to see the coronation on 20 million TV sets, and that's how they were going to invade the minds and bodies of all the people. So I think there may be some tie to that could explain the entirety of Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes. It's The Wire. Oh. But I enjoyed this episode, but the face thing was silly. I point that out. I like the episode. It's a period of time. The 50s is a period of time where there is not a lot of parallels between the United States and Britain. I don't know if that's the right way to phrase it, but if you want to look back at the history of the two countries since the Revolution, of course, we've drifted apart in many ways over the two centuries. And then with the advent of television, I think the two countries have culturally come back closer together. Simply because you guys get to see American television, we get to see British television. Prior to that, there wasn't that interplay. And so the 1950s is about the peak of the divergency between the two of us. And so the settings and the places and the way they lived is not as familiar if we look back to what we see as the 50s. So it's probably the most alien environment that Britain can produce for us is that sort of pre-television era. It's hard for me to judge how well realized it is. It looks good. I suspect it probably is historically accurate, and certainly it's a fun story. I particularly like the ending. The sort of Legopolis flashbacks there at the end of that story, but it was a light piece overall. Ben, you with us?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about what the heck to say. This was an episode that just it rather underwhelmed me. There was, and maybe it has something to do with a point you just made, and that was how American culture and U.S. culture was prior to the advent of television. I mean, we were not necessarily at odds, but we were most definitely different. And so to see English culture at that time, British culture, it's something that it's easy for me to relate somehow to a setting on an alien planet than it was for me to relate to this. I had a very difficult time. You know, I'm not calling this. I'm not saying that this is a criticism of the story. It's more of a criticism of myself, in that I just had a very hard time getting into this episode. It just did not do much for me at all.
I'd have enjoyed it more if they'd made more of the 1950s setting and I just didn't like the monster. Basically, I thought it felt crowbarred in again. You could have had a 1950s pure historical, but they're not going to do any pure historical, so I'll get down off my soapbox.
Yeah, that's a shame. Shall we move on to
Human Nature and the Family of Blood?
Oh, this should be interesting.
In terms of pulling out the counterpoint between the Doctor as an alien and actually then saying, okay, what if the Doctor were human? What would the differences be there? And to actually play those differences out. And I think the setting works really well, because you've got it's again a slightly removed setting. So some of the cultural attitudes are now quite surprising to us, but they're different from the attitudes of this sort of well-traveled, seen-it-all alien that we're used to. And I also think that the alien threat in this case, although really all it serves is a reason for the Doctor to be hiding in a boys' school just before the Great War, it actually, some of the imagery there worked really well. I thought the scarecrows were pretty scary. It's a Moffat-esque monster in that sense.
All right, that's fair enough. I didn't like this episode. It has its moments. You're right. The scarecrows are kind of interesting. The pre Great War, and again, this is another situation where I'm sure that the experience prior to World War I was very different in the UK than it was for us, because the United States was not, well, we were, you know, isolationist, if you would argue that we aren't now, but there was no real expectation of the war coming to the United States, and UK being in part of Europe and being part of the treaties and whatnot, that it's a very different feel to that, to anything you see about the coming times of the war in the United States. And I have had an uncle who was in that war, and have talked with him at some length, mostly about his footwear, apparently it was appalling down in the trenches and whatnot, but they had a very different attitude prior to the war. It's not as resigned. It's not as it's an interesting period piece to see that in the world as it was and whatnot. But I could not. The problem is I could not buy the premise. The premise that the Doctor would run and hide from these creatures, first off, doesn't make any sense to me. It just doesn't. From a story standpoint, it's like, that's just silly. I mean, the Doctor just wouldn't. You're telling me that anywhere in time and space he can run with that TARDIS, he can't escape these bloodhounds, that he has to just transform himself into a human and lay low for a while? It's like, won't they just wait? Well, that's half the problem. And the other half of the problem is that when he does return to being a Time Lord, he whips them with one hand tied behind his back, and he does it in a vindictive and mean-spirited way. But it shows that they were never, ever a threat to the Doctor if he didn't want them to be a threat. And so
somewhere that came across, and I make this was the first and probably, as far as I'm aware, the only story that was adapted from a novel. And somewhere there's an explanation of this, and I'm a bit worried that I've got it out of the novel, but it's because the Doctor doesn't want to do that he hides from them. It's not because they're a threat to him, it's because he's a threat to them.
I don't think that was in the episode, but I'll admit I have not gone back and watched that one anytime recently, but it did seem like mostly just a contrivance in retrospect to bring the Master back and make up for the fact that earlier the Doctor said to Rose, you know, if there were any other Time Lords out there, I'd know. You know, they had to find a way to hide him completely from the Doctor. And that would have, it just seems like that was a setup for it.
Although they can't approach it from that point of view, because if they were adapting this novel, and that's in the original novel.
Yeah.
They would have. I mean, I thought, because I knew that, it made it doubly surprising when that was the device that they used to hide the Master. I thought that was very clever.
In that respect, so they've co-opted it to use to save the Master is good of them. I don't know. It just feels overly contrived. Is really what it gets out to. Of all the things the Doctor could come up with, just suddenly this is the hiding button, and I didn't like that aspect of it, it's too long.
The other thing in the novel, and I'm pretty sure this isn't in the TV series, is that he's always wanted to try it out.
That's definitely not in the TV series, yeah. Interesting. And see, even that kind of makes it lesserly contrived. English is failing me there. Ben, I know you love this one.
Oh, yeah, right. I have very little fondness for this episode. And part of it is largely to what you just said. I could not believe for a moment that the Doctor would run the way that he was running. And the sense that I got, even if this was adapted from a story, and the explanation of the story is that he didn't want to destroy them, or he didn't want to come across as he wasn't threatening to them, whatever that was, his reaction in this episode alone was that of, I'm on the run for my life. That's how he was acting. And I could not buy that, especially at the end of the episode, where he does so handedly whip them and imprison them or whatever. I mean, he grants them their wishes of eternal life, just obviously not the way that they wanted it. But the fact that he could do that so without breaking a sweat made everything leading up to it kind of disingenuous. And I felt that this episode came across as something of a Dr. Light. Even though David Tennant had a prominent role in the episode, even though we saw him all over the place, we didn't have the Doctor. The Doctor was removed from the story as an active element. So that's just a personal preference on my part. And it just did not work for me as a story. I didn't care for it one bit. And I was forced to watch it recently because there was something that I was looking for, that I was trying to find something.
They tied you up and made you watch that.
Well, no, but I was under the impression for whatever reason that maybe there was an element that I was looking for as part of a bigger picture, so I forced myself to watch it again in the hopes that I would find this, and it turned out it was a hopeless cause. And I just... even after watching it again, I just felt it left me with a bad taste in my mouth. This was just not an episode that I enjoyed. For me personally, I could not accept the Doctor's actions in using the watch to mask himself and become entirely human. It was a cheap plot device. One that I felt was completely unnecessary.
See, I'm not going to disagree with either of you that it was a device. It was a contrivance, and I think I've probably mentioned that. The aliens were only there for that purpose. But I think the effect was terribly... It revealed something about the Doctor, and you had this, whatever it's called, the Diary of Travels in Space or whatever. You had the Doctor looking at his own life in that book and seeing it from an outsider's perspective. And in the same way, I suppose, that I like the episodes where you do see the Doctor from an outsider's perspective, that was something I really enjoyed about it.
It did have the sketches of the previous Doctors in there too. That was, I think, the first time that showed up, didn't it? In the series. Fires of Pompeii.
Yeah, the Fires of Pompeii is another one where I just think that there's an alien in there for no particularly valid reason, really. I mean,
Pompeii isn't big enough. You know, Vesuvius going off isn't enough.
I'm going to go on my pure historical thing again, but actually I've got evidence this time because there is an audio story set on the eve of the eruption of Vesuvius called the Fires of Vulcan, I believe.
Yes.
And that is a pure historical, and that is a very effective story in a way that I didn't quite get. It didn't tie together. I didn't quite understand what it was that was making the soothsayers all sooth instead of
say. Yes.
Well, instead of, you know, bunkum say.
Yeah.
The normal service.
That audio drama was Sylvester McCoy and Bonnie Langford, yes.
It was good.
I did hear that one. It's a bit of a farce, too, as I recall, wasn't it? It was a little bit...
No, it was pretty straight, I thought.
It's been a long time since I listened to that one, but I do remember that Bonnie Langford wasn't horrid like she was in the actual series. Sorry, Bonnie, but your character was terrible. In the original, anyway.
It's a massive improvement on that.
They did a lot of that in the Big Finish audience. They fixed up Colin Baker a lot. They made Perry less whiny. They did a good job there. Fires of Pompeii, I don't have a lot to say about that one. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think it's a nice episode for Donna to demonstrate her humanity versus the Doctor's detached Time Lord upbringing. I don't think they mention the term fixed point in time, but I think this is the first instance where that concept is brought up in the new series that, oh, this is a spot we can't mess with. The magma monster and was it the gases that were making the people see the future? The future Amy Pond was one of them.
It
was the daughter in the family there, as I recall. And, it's interesting how they keep picking companions based on somebody they've had in the show already.
That's been going on for some time. I mean, they did that with Colin Baker.
Well, they didn't pick him as a companion, did they? No. But, not a whole lot. This was just an interesting... Vesuvius is a fascinating event for me because it's geologic and I'm that way. But I didn't hate it. Ben?
I felt pretty much the same way. The only thing that was interesting is... who wrote this one again?
James Moran, I think.
Okay, well, because it had Russell's fingerprints all over it. With just the little hints and clues of things yet to come. That was the only thing that was even remotely interesting about this episode. Well, and Donna. Again, I tip my hat to her acting, she could definitely reach beyond just broad comedy and show a lot of sensitivity. So I liked the companion and just the little bits of the puzzle that was yet to come. And on a side note, I found that the little pieces of the puzzle were far more interesting than the puzzle than the sum of its own parts, shall we say. Those are the only things about this episode that I liked. The rest of it I thought was kind of, okay, let's move on.
Fair enough.
Vampires of Venice is the last in this category. I'm sounding like a stuck record here. I didn't understand why we had to have another alien monster in there. Not only this, we had vampires and the alien monster thing, and I kind of thought vampires might provoke a bigger reaction from the Doctor, having seen State of Decay, which I guess most people watching wouldn't have done, but nevertheless, it would have made more sense.
There's no doubt that the Doctor would know that there are real vampires. In the Doctor Who universe, vampires are real. They are aliens, but they are a real thing. And it didn't really come off that way.
Mythological thing that the Doctor discovers are real.
Right. Right. But by this point in his time stream, he's met a vampire, so he knows it's real, and he almost immediately doesn't seem to treat them that way. He seems to treat them as being, well, they're not vampires. May I just get that feeling out of it, but anyway.
I suppose you could explain it in terms of he's met a vampire and he knows what one looks like and that ain't one.
Could be.
But I don't know.
They don't have the eye makeup.
Yeah, that's true. Having said that and having criticised it for that, I did really enjoy the episode because it was very, very funny. This is a Toby Whithouse episode, I think. And although School Reunion had a lot of things to enjoy in it, I didn't enjoy it as an episode as much as I found this one entertains me. So I thought the performances and the writing were really good. It was just having another monster crowbarred in there that ticked me off slightly.
It was an episode that had a lot of illogical plot points, like the whole burning up in the sunlight, and yet they're out in the sunlight, and it's when they need it to have sunlight work on them, then it does, and when they don't need it to have sunlight, then they can go out and just have a little veil on, and it's sort of things like that that didn't make a whole lot of sense from the story. It did have some funny bits in it. It had that cake scene at the beginning, which I didn't like.
Oh, I loved that.
It had its, and if you set that up aside and said, look at this scene, is this funny? Yes, it is. Is it, can you buy that the doctor would do that? No, I can't. I guess.
It's still making me laugh thinking about it. And Matt Smith's delivery in the whole of that was just wonderful. I mean, talking about the doctor not being human, well, that I thought really accentuated his slightly separate from our culture nature.
I think Ben and I have probably beat that to death, but, you know, yes, the doctor is an alien, and Matt Smith has nailed this from day one. I don't think there's been an episode in the current series where he hasn't been absolutely right on key with exactly what I think they were going for. But at the same time, every once in a while, I think, what has he forgotten? Because John Pertwee could certainly function among humans and not make a mistake like that. Tom Baker could even function among humans and not make a mistake. All of them previously could have done that. And yet Matt Smith seems to be as if he's forgotten what he's learned about humans over the years.
I could see Sylvester McCoy make that same mistake.
Well, go ahead, Simon.
I'm just trying to recollect which episodes John Pertwee and Tom Baker met a stripper in.
Well, I don't think they did. Maybe after the show, after taping, but
Tom Baker
certainly, yeah. But I mean, he just wouldn't make the mistake of jumping out of a cake or not seeming to understand what's going on at the Bachelor. I don't know. It happens again later on, like in The Lodger, where the doctor just doesn't seem to be able to function. Yeah, it's just kind of an odd little piece there, but. There's some stuff to recommend Vampires in Venice. It's not an all loss in my book. It has its Rory moments in it that's probably Rory's poorest episode to me. He's kind of in that doctor rivalry mode, and we really haven't gotten to the point where we like him later on. But I don't have much more to say about it. Ben?
Oh, wow. Where do I begin on this one? First off, Rory. I really did not like him in this particular episode. I found a lot of contradiction. Most notably...
It's because he's an Auton.
Well, yeah, he's an Auton. And that explains why he was totally unfazed when he walks into the TARDIS. He walks in there and we know what people are supposed to do. We know what people are supposed to say. Even the doctor comments on it that he's supposed to say, but it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And Rory comes off with this, well, I read these books and I know this and I know that. And yet when they go back to Venice, he's a complete incompetent. I mean, to the point where he's just really useless. And in the way at every turn, and I found that to be highly irritating. He served to be more of a distraction for this episode, and I couldn't deal with him. As far as the vampires go, I felt that was just simply an attempt to capitalize on the big vampire craze that's going on right now. So in that respect, yes, I would say that maybe these vampires were sort of pushed into this story as your enemy.
What vampire craze?
Don't ask.
I'm not answering that one.
This is like the Vampire Lestat's back at it again or something?
Oh, please. You're not. Don't even.
All right. Okay.
What, are you joking with me?
You
don't know what's going on in the cinemas right now?
Well, not really.
I envy you.
It's like, oh, wait. You've got full moon or something.
Thank you. The fact is that both on telly and in cinemas, there is a vampire craze going on right now. So that's the only reason why this episode, or at least that's why the vampires were in this episode.
Is that who those guys are that are on the cups at Burger King?
Most likely.
Pasty white little 12-year-old model guys?
Yeah.
The boy band or whatever they look like? Yeah.
Yeah, that's them.
Ah, they're supposed to be vampires.
Yes,
okay,
they are.
I'm not menaced. I am immediately not menaced by them. Okay, so what's the best? Who wants to go first? This is a tough one.
I'm sorely, sorely tempted to pick Human Nature and the Family of Blood because I know it really annoy you guys. And I do love it. I think it is. I mean, this is. If it weren't up against some pretty strong competition, I would go for it. It is one of my favourite episodes, favourite stories. But The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances is just even better. I think that's possibly my all-time favorite Doctor Who story, so I'm going with that.
All right, Ben?
Same. Empty Child, Doctor Dances. Excellent. It's just an excellent episode. It had, even with its imperfections, it had some really, really strong elements that resonate and feel like classic Doctor Who.
We have a slam dunk there. All three. That's it. Empty Child, Doctor Dances. Christopher Eccleston scores one.
Wow.
And so we come to the end of part four of our discussion on who is the best doctor. As the score stands now, David Tennant is in third place with only 3 points. Matt Smith is in second with 4, and Christopher Eccleston has come from behind and taken the lead at 5 points. Next time, in the battle of the series finale, will Eccleston's parting of the ways be able to hold off against such juggernauts as Doomsday, Journey's End, The Last of the Time Lords, and The Big Bang? Find out, and we hope you'll join us again next time.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. Contact us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com or follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fusionpatrol.
Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.